circuits.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle, here with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Good to hear your voice again.
All right. Well, last week we had a really interesting on-air session, Dr. Lyle, with you and Amy, and we got to learn a little bit about your techniques for uncovering the mysteries of depression. And in this particular case, Amy was depressed, and we found out why and kind of helped her out of this, and now she knows what she can do. This leads me to this article I was reading last couple of weeks ago, and it said that people with autism are three times as likely as the general population to have depression, and that the higher functioning a person with autism is, the more likely they are to be depressed. And so I'm thinking, well, you know, someone with autism, I'm not an expert, and I've heard, I've assumed that perhaps there's something going on with the internal audience where people may be treating them a little bit differently and not giving them as the same esteem signals that they otherwise would if they didn't have autism. And I figured the higher functioning a person with autism is the more likely they are to be able to read these cues from other people. And so that's why they're more likely to be depressed. But I figured I'd ask the expert and see what you have to say about this.
Actually, that's really interesting. That's a curious pattern of results. So the more autistic you are, the less likely you are to be depressed. But if you're mildly autistic, then you're very likely to be depressed. Or much more likely. So that's very interesting. I would modify your understanding of my understanding of how the mind is constructed. You've got an internal audience, which is really a device for watching your own rehearsals and then giving you feedback on rehearsals to the esteem meter. The esteem meter is a device for essentially deciphering communication from the outside world in terms of esteem signals or also cues from the internal audience, which actually acts as a facsimile of the outside world as if it's separate consciousnesses. I don't think it's the internal audience here that you're talking about. I think you've got it right as you kept talking. I think you got it straight. That what you have is you've got a steam meter that is picking up cues of rejection. And so the person, they are picking up cues of rejection because they do odd things and they don't compete very effectively for esteem. They could be brilliant and they could be kind or they could be difficult people or whatever else is that they are. But the truth of the matter is, on average, they're going to be acting odd and they're not going to be sending very good esteem signals to other people very often because they just don't have these chips they're not very smooth here. So as a result, they're not going to stoke these reciprocal esteem dynamics, which is the heart of, you know, the what's good in human life. So as a result, they should be winding up with greater periods of deprivation for getting an adequate or threshold level of signals to keep people from getting depressed, and therefore they're more likely to be depressed. So that's actually really interesting. Now that I hear you explain what that study found, I would speculate that that's what's happening. They're just aware enough and just got enough ability to read the cues that they are actually seeing that they are esteem deficient, and they're puzzled, and they don't know what to do to fix it, And so they do, you know, it sounds like a fair amount more suffering than the average bear. So, yeah, I think that's what's going on. Yeah, it could also be just neurochemical differences, but and that's maybe in there too. But I think that you're onto something. I think that's probably a significant part of the problem.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. So this leads us into our next question from one of our listeners,
right,
which is, Dr. Lyle, I recently read that 13% of Americans are taking some sort of antidepressant. What do you think is the reason behind so many people not feeling happy? Could it be the sedentary modern lifestyle is so out of tune with the environment in which we evolved? Or have we always been as unhappy, but antidepressants simply weren't an option?
I would say that the following is true, that there's always going to be, and probably always has been, a fair amount of unhappiness. But remember that unhappiness is a condition that is conditional. So the brain is signaling unhappiness or depression because the person is picking up cues, mostly social cues. Rather, like, you could be depressed because, you know, you're in a lot of physical pain, or you're hungry, and there's, you know, you're cold, et cetera. So in other words, you can have problems vis-a-vis you and nature and your biology that will make you depressed. But mostly what human beings are depressed about, and what depression is a signal for, is it's a failure feedback signal. And so it's a signal, and almost all of the success or failure issues have to do with competitive esteem processes. So the most depressive feelings, I always don't like this notion of calling something depression, like it's some frickin' disease that visits people like a plague. No, that's not what it is. It's a condition under which the person is now operating, about what the circumstances of their life are, and when the conditions change, the depression will change. So depression is a feedback mechanism. So now the question is, has there always been a lot of depression? Well, sure. People, you have to have depression as a signal of failure feedback. So when Fang was trying to find, you know, Fanny, you know, back in the Stone Age, and trying to mate with her, and she first was kind of interested and then talked to him a little longer, then rejected him, he's depressed. Okay? And so this is he's designed this way. He's designed by nature to experience that depression in the face of failure feedback. He was, you know, trying to ascend a little hierarchy and have his head on a totem pole or whatever, and the elders said no. Okay, you're not ready, you're not good enough, you disappointed us with this or that, and he gets failure feedback and he's depressed. So the depression is the mirror image of happiness, and happiness is the result of evidence that we are included and invited and valued by the group at a level that we would consider to be appropriate with what it is that we think that we have to trade. Depression is the result of getting feedback from the world or esteem signals that signal that our value is less than we would have expected or hoped for, and therefore the system is frustrated. And at first it's frustrated and irritated and motivated, and then with eventually enough negative feedback, despite a person's little tiny permutations on how they do things, to try to do things a little bit differently to get more successful. So you keep trying to bring, you know, Fanny, you know, flowers and then a fish and some other things, something else that starts with F. I don't know what it is. But the point is that he tries to bring her, and nothing works. Okay? So now what finally happens is he gets depressed. So depression is a signal for the organism to read that it's time to stop investing time and energy in that strategy, that is a dead strategy. It's not likely to yield appropriate cost-benefit residuals, and so therefore don't do it. And the feeling is bummed out. That's what the signal is. It's not energetic and happy and investing a bunch of energy in a continued failed behavioral trajectory. It's a signal that says stop. Okay, now, the question is, do we have more of it in the modern life than we've had before, et cetera? Hard to say. Probably it wouldn't be super dissimilar. I would expect people would always be, you know, some people are headed bitterly down a dominance hierarchy or in bitter rejection situation, et cetera, or unhealthy, worried about this or that. In other words, there's always trouble in life. So I don't know that there's statistically more today than there's ever been. But let's look at some situations that we know that are probably exacerbating the problem pretty substantially. So the person mentions discrepancies between the modern and the Stone Age environment. I have no doubt that these are a major issue. So, for example, the food that people is eating is pretty lousy, and so they probably don't feel that good. And when you don't feel that good, you're more likely to be depressed. They also are staying up too late, and they're short of sleep, and they're drugging themselves with coffee and other things. And so they've got drugs, cigarettes, alcohol, coffee, and everything else under the sun. And this is beating up the nervous system, disrupting restorative processes, and therefore the nervous system is not under ideal conditions. So that's going to be an issue. There's going to be discrepancies in what we could be able to do in terms of competitive presentation and in particularly sexual dynamics versus probably where we are as a result of the modern pleasure trap. So a lot of people are overweight and they are not very fit and in very good condition relative to what it is that they know that they could be. And so therefore the discrepancy between their potential and what is a disturbing problem. And this causes them to be non-competitive with people that they would want to compete for or that their brains analyze that it would be potentially legitimately within their reach. And because of the pleasure trap, they are not there. And so that probably causes a lot of loneliness and frustration and lack of happiness and depression as a result of that. Additionally, the modern environment is sedentary, as the person mentions here. So I have no doubt that a lack of exercise is a major issue in essentially depressogenic moods, that you are designed by nature to have certain neurochemical systems be invoked, put into place, then put to rest, etc. And so I have no doubt that, and I know there's evidence for this, but just forget about the evidence for a minute. Just think about animals in a zoo sitting around getting fed. This is not conducive to happiness. The animals are designed by nature to have to execute exacting behavioral programs under stressful choice environments in order to get enough food to survive and to also survive and not get eaten. If they do those things, they're doing what that animal is designed to do. Okay. And if they're not doing those things, then they're not doing what the animal is designed to do. So you've got muscles for a reason, and you're designed by nature to be contracting those muscles fairly vigorously on a daily basis. And so when you do that, that will dissipate a bunch of stress, have the person be healthier, have the person sleep more deeply and completely at night, etc. So now this is all coming full circle into everything. Now, it's also true that the modern environment has the capacity to have people live without real deep connections. Now, a lot of people have a lot of deep connections, and that's fine. But a lot of people don't, or they feel a paucity of deep connection. So I just had a wonderful young lady call me today and ask me the specific question of how do you foster deep connections. It was a great, great question, and I only vaguely considered it. Tubian Cosmides wrote on this, 20 years ago, and got my attention on this issue. The deep connections are forged out of particular circumstances. So those circumstances are generally two things. They are repeat exposure environments, and they are also environments that require risk, vulnerability, and effort, and intermittent sacrifice. So what are we looking at? We're looking at what happened in the Stone Age village, that people had to go out of their way to help each other because people got into trouble. And so they would form that this is the way you know that somebody has your back, is because some shit happened and then they were there. Okay? If your life is very smooth and you have Allstate insurance and everything's cool and you belong to the union and you're all buffered in, then you don't necessarily have significant vulnerabilities. And that's actually fundamentally a good thing. So, of course, the modern world has been marching towards us being more and more and more and more secure, which is actually objectively a good thing. But one of the problems that this faces is that there's no glory in it with respect to the individual relationships. So if a person never has anybody, if they never have stretched themselves, gotten vulnerable, taken a risk that got them, that had the potential to be vulnerable and in trouble, and therefore never had anybody have to step in and help, then they never know if anybody cares enough to step in and help. And if they've never in parallel done that for anybody else, then they've never proven that they would be the stand-up guy or girl that would help that individual. So you might say, well, what am I supposed to do? Go look for people in trouble? Not necessarily, but here's the issue. The issue is that you can't force deep connection. The formula is, this is the natural formula is how this has to work. This is why people, you know, have this feeling that, I've heard some absurd marital counselors talk about how you just tough it out and this is what love is and it's just grinding through the hell and all that. Well, the thing is if you have a conscientious partner that's a pretty darn decent human being and you slug through your complete sexually dead below the waist relationship for 25 years, but the person's a damn good stand-up person and so are you, and you raise a couple of kids, then you do love the person and you're deeply connected to them. And the two of you have earned something there. Now, if you don't actually like who they are as a person, not all the repeat exposure in the world or the sacrifice, et cetera, is going to do it. You have to like who the heck they are. But the best situations have to do with when you are struggling in some way in your life for some kind of growth. And what's happening is that you, in that struggle, you're having to reach a little bit. And the reaching causes you to be vulnerable. And when that happens, this could be, for example, in a myriad of ways. So in a psychotherapy office, a guy comes in and he's got a big problem. But he's not going to trust that therapist right away. So he throws him a little problem and sees what happens. And then he throws him another little problem and sees what happens. And then he throws him another little problem and sees what happens. And then if the therapist earns the trust, then he throws him the big one. That would make sense. Repeat exposure effects, testing to see who the other person really is on the other side of this equation. And then we make ourselves vulnerable. It's in the making of ourselves vulnerable where we can make substantial improvements in our lives. But that vulnerability, that comes at a price. We have exposed ourselves in some fashion. And so this is where people can prove to us that they're valuable and that they care about us. And this is where deep connections are formed. So I've met a guy in the last year, really interesting, really smart guy, knows a bunch of stuff about human natural history that I don't know. And we kind of both would like to be friends. And he's a very interesting character, to say the least. And we actually enjoy talking to each other. But the thing is that we don't have anything that either one of us is doing that the other one is really helpful in helping guard vulnerability. And so this is where Aristotle said, you know, you may want to be friends and you may see it, but you can't force it. It just happens naturally. In the Stone Age, it happened naturally. People were in vulnerable circumstances. They did have deep connections. There was, you know, they proved themselves or didn't prove themselves. And they wound up in these village atmospheres knowing that they were deeply connected to some number of people. That is something that can be and often is missing in the modern environment, and that is going to be a source of depression because at a fundamental level, you feel insecure and you feel like you're not in a group. So that's another thing. Another issue in the modern environment is all these things that I'm talking about are things that can happen in the modern environment that cause us to get our lives out of balance with human nature. So whether it's food, sleep, you know, physical fitness, exercise, lack of deep connection, okay? And another one is the overinvestment in pseudo-esteem. So this is, you know, you've got three levels of esteem. You've got self-esteem, the internal audience signaling as it watches your efforts. You've got actual esteem from people that really know what value proposition you bring to their given market, and they give you signals back on how much they value or don't value you. And then finally, you have pseudo-esteem, which is just sheer reputation, and people are looking for cues of who it is that you are rather than knowing for sure what it is that you're about. And the pseudo-esteem, because of its extraordinary potential efficiency, because it's, you know, reputational rather than earned sort of the hard way in real life human interchange, pseudo-esteem is very seductive. And so this is where we get luxury fever of human beings seeking luxury, flashy, you know, whether it's degrees or whether it's cars or whether it's your wife's hair or whether it's the fancy vacations or the kids in the private school. I'm not knocking any of these potentially useful values for people. What I'm saying is that it's very easy for there is a seductive quality to pseudo-esteem that is a very close pleasure parallel to the pleasure trap. And in other words, it's a super normal stimuli. And as a result, it can get people's lives out of balance just the way junk food can get it out of balance. So the person asking this question is saying, you know, what's the deal? And the answer is you're absolutely right. There's a lot of stuff going on in the modern environment that are things that are pulling people's happiness, you know, away from where it could be. There's also fantastic things in the modern environment that make it better. Okay, so I think that when we, you know, the modern environment has many things. I'm glad I'm not worried about predators every time I go to sleep. So I'm not worried about hunger. So there are things about the modern environment that are enormously positive. But if we're not careful, we can essentially squander the opportunity that the modern environment gives us by essentially allowing our life to get out of balance. And when it gets out of balance, there's a nice little signal there waiting there to tell us that it's out of balance, and it's called depression. And then, of course, what happens is that we go to the shrink, and what they put 13% of modern America on antidepressants. So now what they're going to do is they're going to put the chemistry of the brain out of balance, for God's sakes. So that's the move that they make. They don't know any better. You know, they know not what they do. And so that's not, obviously not the solution to the problem. So the solution to the problem is to intelligently get back to the basics: food, sleep, exercise, physical fitness, deep connection, through earning esteem in the right way from the people that matter, and also examining where our life circumstances and our life histories have walked us into the ego trap. And the ego trap, you know, is easy enough to spring on people and can be a very intimidating thing. And in the modern environment, it can effectively be permanent, which is something that the Stone Age environment, it could never be. The ego trap is a biological adaptation for human beings to protect their status as long as they can hold on to it. They're running simply a derivative of cost-benefit analysis of whether or not to take the risk to expose the fact that other people think more highly of us than is true. And they think we're fancier than we are. And in the Stone Age, we could hold on to it for a little while by essentially avoiding challenge and engagement in that display. But in the modern environment, you can do it indefinitely. So people are unwittingly by others, well-meaning others, very often walked into the ego trap with, you know, I don't know, the John Denver Award or the Emily Dickinson Award or you know, you're going to be so great or you can do this and blah, blah. No end to the ego trap signaling that goes on. And as a result, people can spend a lifetime or at least a significant portion of their lifetime battling ego trap problems that lead to, you know, depression and personal frustration. So this is sort of I didn't expect to take this question out this far, but this is a, you know, this is actually a big, comprehensive, sweeping question that was asked. And when we actually, when we look at the whole CinemaScope of the problem, I would say once again, the modern environment has spectacular opportunities, but it also has very, very seductive traps. And so this podcast is about helping people be aware of those traps and attempting to act against those in order to be able to forge the best possible existence.
Fantastic.
All right. Good, that's enough.
All right. I think that was great, Dr. Lau. And, you know, I was thinking with your friend who you guys are having trouble kind of finding a common, well, not a common
yeah.
ground, but I was thinking,
yeah.
what if you go
common
play
goal.
Basketball two? Yeah, like what if you go play basketball 2-on-2 and then show them that you can sacrifice, take one for the team and vice versa? Would that connect you together, even though it's not, you know,
yeah.
intellectually related?
I hadn't thought about that. All right.
But no,
right,
I know it's a
good.
Joke, but okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I know it's a joke,
actually,
but I figure
any,
people are struggling
sure.
with this. Can't they just join a sports team? I mean, it's not the same thing as hunting and sacrificing your life,
yes.
but, you know, you do a team sport and maybe you might get something close.
You could. In other words, you could get something little. You could get facsimiles of this, particularly sports which have within them the potential for self-sacrifice. So, and there would be sports would have that in differing degrees. So, yeah, no, I hear you. There's a, I'm sure I'm just so much better at him. No, I'm just kidding.
I like this.
All
now
right.
It's up to him to prove you wrong.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. See if I get
All
a
right.
phone call. Okay. All right.
All
Where
right.
are we going?
The next question. What's the Doug download on Viktor Frankl, who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning? What school is Frankl a part of, and do you agree with his conclusion that meaning was the variable in those who had the will to survive? And also related, small question, what is the meaning of life?
Viktor Frankl was one of a number of mid-century, I don't know what you would call them, philosophers, psychologists, humanists, etc., that what was kind of his thinking was not constrained by the sort of dual giants in the field of psychology at that point, which were psychoanalysis and behaviorism. So I don't know a lot about how Frankl went about doing this thing. I read Man's Search for Meaning, you know, a long time ago. I've always been frustrated with that phrase, and the first of all, the concept that, you know, he the first half of the book, he is really writing about, I'm not sure which half of the book is which, I actually don't remember, but half of the book he writes about his experiences in the concentration camps, and then the other half of the book he's writing about his personal philosophy and the way some ways he tries to do psychotherapy and the way we look at life, etc. So I think the first half of the book is about the concentration camp and the second half of the book is about his personal philosophy, but I'm actually not sure, but I think that that's how it works. And the notion that the people that sort of did well, I don't know, had some, what do you call, It was their outlook and their it's a power of mind that they survived and the other ones didn't. This has sort of been held up and hallowed as, you know, this deep, great thought of Viktor Frankl or people like that, and which is ridiculous. The truth of the matter is that this is the notion that you're, first of all, there's no evidence that that's true. Second of all, we also have to understand that people's personalities are genetic, and therefore the quote attitude that they're going to have about this situation is going to be essentially overwhelmingly determined by the inherited personality characteristics that they have. So the notion that there's choice here and outlook, et cetera, is naive. And that's okay. I mean, there may be, obviously, someone who is more emotionally stable, okay, and more conscientious or not too conscientious, you can put together a perfect personality for being in a concentration camp and out of the big five plus IQ. And those are the individuals who are going to wind up psychologically not as disturbed, okay, obviously. So the idea that the latent idea that sits under this is that the philosophical outlook of the person could maneuver them into that ideal spot is naive and no surprise. Obviously, Viktor Frankl wouldn't have known anything about behavior genetics. And so he's writing in ignorance of that and doing the best he can. And he made some observations and so on and so forth. Now, I've always had, this guy and a lot of these guys, I enjoy reading and did enjoy reading these guys back in the day, whether it was Carl Rogers and even Fritz Perls and these sort of innovative thinkers that had some unusual experiences and told some good stories and had some nice, philosophical distillations. That I'm sure have been very useful for many people. I remember one specific technique out of Frankl's logotherapy that I've used a few times, and I've actually probably used it more times on myself than I ever used in psychotherapy. It was a nice little mental technique, which is that right about the time you're about to screw up and do something that you know is not the right thing to do, what you want to do is you want to like think through that you did this screwed up thing. You've now done it, okay? And you now have a big mess because of it. So go ahead and think about that mess. And then think about the fact that you get a chance to do a do-over. And now you're going to do it the second time, only this time you're going to do it right, okay? And so this kind of mental mindset has been useful for me on a few occasions, and I've used it a few times clinically with other folks. So I think that if people look through Viktor Frankl I'm sure he's got many nuggets in there that can be useful for people. But the notion, his sort of notion about speculating about the meaning of life, et cetera, let's get clear. Life has no meaning. That is an incorrect way of using the language. It's beautifully mysterious to use that phrase. And that phrase, man's search for meaning has a beautiful artistic, tickling that goes on. But let's use the language properly. There's no such thing as the meaning to life. Life has purpose. Okay? So now we're going to change the question a little bit. What is the purpose of life, or man's search for purpose? Well, when you start talking about man's search for purpose, man or woman's search, man in quotes, meaning the species and the individual of the species, what is the purpose? Okay? Well, if we're a philosopher writing before Richard Dawkins, we don't know. Which is what Frankl was, okay? That makes him very smart guy, insightful, kind, probably a very fine psychotherapist, but it makes him ignorant of what the purpose of life was. So the purpose of life, clear, it's gene replication. Okay? So now that we know the purpose of life, we can skip over the lofty ideas of the meaning of life or that man's searching for the meaning of life. Man found what that was. Okay? His name was Charles Darwin. He figured it out. Okay? So the purpose of life is gene replication. And now we're going to look at the purpose of your life. So the purpose of your life is not gene replication. The purpose of your life is actually to co-opt the machinery that is in there for gene replication and to try to optimize this thing that we call your life experience, i.e. your happiness. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to hack the system. We're trying to game it. Okay? We're trying to not get sucked into how the thing is actually built, which is to optimize gene reproduction. And instead, what we're going to try to do is we just want the little scorekeeping device to go off in our head that goes off when we've done things that the system thinks are great for gene reproduction, but actually we're just trying to ring up a big score of the scorekeeping system, i.e. the moods of happiness. We're just trying to activate the happiness circuits because we want the best possible ride of this time-limited thing that we call life. Okay, so now we can answer this deep question that everybody's trying to answer. What's the meaning of life? There is no meaning of life. Okay, well, Doug, what's the purpose of life? Well, the reasonable purpose of your life is to activate your happiness circuits in any way that you can do it. And if you can sit there and activate those happiness circuits optimally by watching a video game, then have at it. Okay, what we're going to find string of causal mating strategy experiences, okay? Or, I don't know, trying to win a Super Bowl. Like, there's all kinds of different ways to activate the happiness circuits. What we're trying to do is to get the best possible ride. Ultimately, what this is going to mean is it's going to mean that you're going to need to understand your own machine. And this is the concept of identity. So your identity is more complete and all-encompassing than your personality. So your personality is this sort of scores that we use to describe the differences between you and everybody else. But your identity is far more complex and more subtle. So your identity, my identity is, one of the pieces of my identity is I hate cilantro. Okay? Sorry. I just hate it. Okay? All right? So that's that. Okay, and I like asparagus a lot better than I like broccoli. That's part of my identity. And people, wow, a lot of times like broccoli, they like cauliflower, but I don't like cauliflower. Okay, so
cauliflower is one of my favorite vegetables.
There you go. Okay, so you and I have different identities, and it wouldn't be measured in the Big Five because the Big Five wouldn't predict this. That this goes all the way down into a tremendous degree of subtlety as to the individual differences that we have. So, for example, I'm going to take a wild guess, Nate. I don't know. We're just going to have some fun here. Have you ever read a romance novel?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, let me push further. How many? Okay. Have you read 5, 10, 20? How many do you think you've read?
Let's see. I read a lot of them when I was younger, so I probably not that many. Maybe like one or two, maybe three. Yeah.
Oh, you're serious? Okay, one or two. All right. Well, I've read a couple of hundred. Okay.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So this is an individual, probably an individual difference. It could be that I just found a few authors that were really good, and if you read them, you'd read them too, but probably not. Okay, so this is probably individual difference. I would know for sure that Alan Goldhammer has never read one and never will. Okay, but if somebody that's listening to the show has an outstanding one that they have a lot of confidence in, and they emailed me, I'd look at it. I'd be very interested. All right, so one of the reading thrills of my life was to read Pride and Prejudice. okay?
Wow.
And another two of the great reading thrills of my life was to read Captain from Castile and The Prince of Foxes by Samuel Shellabarger, all right? So the thing is that, you know, so these are individual differences. This is part of my identity. There's people that I know that would never read fiction, okay? Mm-hmm. Could tell a waste of time to them. So these are, there's people that like adventure movies and other people that want to hear stories about cats. So this is identity, and our job is to learn about our identity and try to put ourselves under circumstances by using our available resources, our time, our energy, our intelligence, our social resources, and our money and our ability to make it, to essentially take all the resources that we have and to give ourselves a string of experiences that we think will optimize this life path and activate the moods of happiness most consistently. That's what it is. It turns out that there's a thread through this matrix that is very interesting and important to pay attention to. And one of those is going to be what we call earning esteem. And you will find echoes of earning esteem. They'll find it in Viktor Frankl, and you'll find it everywhere because, you know, people can't miss it, for God's sakes. It's too central to human life. And that's the notion that happiness is going to reliably come from earning esteem in the right way from the people that matter. That's my phrase, but, you know, everybody would resonate to this. Now, you'll get people saying, well, therefore, that's really the purpose of life there is to serve others. No, it's not. Okay? That's one purpose. The truth is there's a whole lot of other things that you can find exciting, like watching the 49ers come back and actually have a decent quarterback and maybe win some games. That's fun too. That will activate the happiness circuits. So our job is not to be selflessly trying to figure out how to serve the village most effectively and get the most esteem this way. That's not what it is. There's a myriad of activities that we can do. And our job is to try to keep this thing in balance. And the way we're going to keep it in balance is paying attention to the cues from our identity to tell us when we're happy and how often we're happy and what the circumstances look like and whether or not we're feeling that internal frustration that we're not using our time and energy that wisely because we're not that happy. Okay? So man's search for meaning is actually search for purpose, and the search for purpose goes through gene replication, but then we're going to hack that very intentionally and realize that it's actually through attempting to optimize our life experience through the activation of the moods of happiness. In order to optimally activate the moods of happiness, we need to get thy own self be true. It means trying to figure out who and what is our identity, and you don't necessarily know. Okay. I didn't know I didn't like cilantro till I tried it, and then somebody told me that it had a name. Okay, now I know. And so the process of living and the process of experimenting and the process of paying attention, pay attention to sometimes the loud voices, which are often there, as well as the subtle voices that will tell us when the system believes that our life could be better. And that's those are the directions that we need to go. And with courage and luck and a good attention to fundamentals and some effort, we can have a substantially better life experience than if we don't pay attention to those things.
Wonderful. Dr. Ladd, do we have time for one caller who's been on hold for a bit?
All right, let's give it a shot.
All right.
Let's see what happens.
Okay, Rakesh. Calling
yes.
Rakesh, he's actually calling from Santa Rosa. Welcome.
Right. Yes, I was there for the last lecture of Dr. Lyle, and I thought I would do a little bit of a survey because I was completely bowled over. I thought that was his best lecture ever. In fact, one of the best lectures that I've ever heard from anyone. So I did a kind of survey, and what is frustrating to note that overwhelmingly people don't seem to buy it. So I wanted to know, is there an evolutionary basis for people not understanding evolution or what you are saying? But on the other hand, it would be very rewarding as well because there was a couple which Benjamin told me bought into this. There's a girl over there called Gabriella. She's completely adores you. And in fact, she gave me the name of the book, The Ape That Understood the Universe, which I'm going to get it for you because I love the book. and she wants to be an evolutionary psychologist. So there are rewards, even if 15 people don't get it. The people who do get it must be rewarding. Is there an evolutionary basis for that? The second question is, women seem to outnumber men 2-1. That's what Dr. Goldhammer told me at True North. Is it the same at the fasting retreat? Is it the same for people who come to see you, Dr. Lyon? And is there an evolutionary basis for that as well?
Okay. All right. I will do my best with these. And I think Rikisha's question was that is there an evolutionary reason why these ideas are sort of difficult for people to grasp and somehow accept? And the answer is yes. There is quite a host of reasons why this would be true. Evolutionary psychology steps on one sacred cow after the next and exposes a lot of it's pretty raw. This is nature red in tooth and claw. It's status and esteem red in tooth and claw. It's uncomfortable. And the discomfort with having competitive processes put in our faces and described, and having objectivity as a major component of status and esteem competitions, and therefore having it not all that everybody's equal but different. As evolutionary psychology says, no, that's not true. There are brains, and there are beauties, and there are behaviors and talent and skill that are inherently better in some respects than others, and as a result, those are rewarded by success and evolution, and that's how nature actually works. The Jeffrey Miller, writing in, I believe it's The Mating Mind, has a couple of pages where I believe that this is maybe 35% of the way through the book, and I hope I've identified the right book, but I think it is. I don't think it's spent. Where he says, are fitness indicators immoral? And that's the notion that the ways that that fitness is demonstrated and evaluated, like beauty, athleticism, intelligence, et cetera, all these things, are we essentially, is morality a kind of a part of a system to try to possibly maintain a bit of social cohesion in the face of the competitive brutality that goes on as fitness indicators and displays clash? And so is it essentially gauche to show off too much and gauche for some people to be so superior to others? In other words, disruptive, potentially disrupting cohesion, etc. So people may be inherently uncomfortable with these ideas and notions, and there may be an evolutionary basis to that. And so, I think that he is probably right. So that's why we find some attractiveness towards humility. And humility being sort of a feeling that says, hey, I don't want that much credit. I don't want to take that much. Partly because I know that it's going to be uncomfortable for other people to lose. So so I think that you're on to something, Rikisha. I believe that there is an evolutionary reason why some of the raw, rough, and tumble ideas of evolutionary psychology are pretty abhorrent to a lot of people. And I think that's probably going to remain so for a long time, indefinitely. Second of all, the other question was about True North, which is a fasting facility and hypernutrition, and Nate's facility as well at fastingescape.com. These are places where we're very interested in human health and the connection between health and nutrition, et cetera. Women are inherently more interested in nutrition than men. I don't know exactly why, but I believe there's probably an evolutionary reason for this. I think they're inherently more concerned that their children be fed
and they're more concerned about that they be fed safely and well. I think those are, so I think these are, these run along feminine lines. So I think that that's true. And so when you see, now I don't know, or maybe it's just more pleasant hanging around food and thinking about food than it is thinking about plumbing and et cetera. So, and the men know that their way to the eggs is to get as many resources as they can. So go do unpleasant things. And the women don't, cannot do probably any more to get to a man's heart other than their sexual attractiveness, other than putting food together in nice ways. So what do I know? But I believe that there's evolutionary reasons for females to be more attracted and interested in the nuances of food just in general than men are. Let me think. I had some follow-up to that, but I've lost it. The
Yeah. Are women more likely to come to you as well?
Oh, yeah, no question.
What would be the ratio over there again?
Yeah, the ratio nationally, the statistics in psychotherapy is that 4 out of 5 psychotherapy clients are women. And yes, it's a huge effect. And my guess is that essentially it is not a good fitness display for males to look like they need to ask for help. So I think that does have a genetic basis, and I would be shocked if it didn't. And I find the same thing myself. But my version of this is the following: that I won't listen to other people give speeches. I just am not interested in listening to anybody else give a speech. And this is clearly. I'm sitting back. If I have to, I'm sitting in the back like, yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. I've got enough sort of natural competitiveness and enough disagreeableness that I'm like, no, not interested. So this is a I've listened to very, very few speeches in my time by anybody. And that, and I'm always amazed that people are willing to sit and listen to us talk, but they are, and I'm glad they do, because I'm trying my best to give good things to say, but I wouldn't listen to me. That's the truth. Okay, thank you very much for calling in, Rakesh. It's a pleasure to hear you.
Rakesh, thank
you very much. Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would have a...
Yep.
I think this is it. Yeah. Okay. Bye.
Very good.
All right. Thanks very much, Rakesh.
Bye.
Yeah, Dr. Lyle, ever since we started the podcast, I can't bring myself to have the patience to listen to very much of other people's ideas on health and happiness and everything like that, just because, like you said, you know, I can see the holes. I may not have the IQ to kind of like create these new ideas, but I can kind of see the holes, and it's like, it's just uncomfortable. It's like, well, I want to hear some, like Dr. Lyle's take on this or others. So.
Yeah, energy conservation. This is exactly why my personal education in the last 40 years has gone down little tributaries where essentially you find a main artery and then you branch off. So from you know Richard Dawkins, I find Hamilton, and then I also find Steven Pinker, and I find Robert Trivers, and Tubian Cosmides, and then David Buss. And so essentially I'm walking down branches because I knew that the main artery was, you know, outstanding. And so in the same way, that's how I've approached everything. It's, you know, some of it's luck. Like I was completely lost in psychology as I entered my final year of my PhD program. And so I'd been formally studying the field for 10 years. And I was just as lost as any psychologist is today. And I think the difference was I hadn't bought into any system because I'm disagreeable enough and alert enough and committed to the truth enough that I just was not going to swallow something and just do it just to be a member of a gang. And I didn't. And so I had just enough openness and just enough confusion and frustration. And something else that has driven the human search for in this arena forever, which is an intuitive knowledge that there's a system. Like, we all know there's a system. We see patterns of behavior everywhere. We're not surprised when the cute girl walks in the room that all the heads go up a turn, you know, the male heads. We're not surprised if, you know, by the things that Mark Twain wrote about in Tom Sawyer, they all make sense to us. So we see patterns, and everybody's been attempting to try to figure out those patterns, and they've had little tiny bits of the truth, little places, but as Jeffrey Miller says, nothing will blow your mind like being introduced to evolutionary psychology, because suddenly you see the patterns everywhere, and suddenly you start to find out that the patterns are, that they are finite. In other words, there's only so many of these patterns. You see that they have all kinds of permutations and combinations, and that you can reason through an amazing amount of observations, that you can figure out just about anything. And you should be able to in principle, because there shouldn't be anything in human behavior or animal behavior that inherently doesn't line up to something that makes a hell of a lot of sense. So this is a special time to finally be alive and have the opportunity to understand this. And it's there's no intellectual joy like this joy, and it's great fun to share it.
Fantastic, Dr. Lau. We're going to end there.
All right, very good. Good talking to you, Nate, and I'll see you this weekend.
Thanks for listening. Fantastic. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.